Sometimes very significant events happen in our lives in very quiet and unspectacular ways and very common settings. Lydia was at the riverside when she was converted. Elisha was doing an ordinary day's work, which he did day after day, week in, week out, when he was called to be a prophet. The Lord entered their lives in the way that would change them forever as they were going about their ordinary, everyday circumstances. And so it is with Abraham this morning as we look at chapter 18 of Genesis. Abraham is at home, sitting quietly outside the door of his tent, something he must have done hundreds of times before. It could hardly have been a more simple scene. There's nothing about this which is in any way unusual. Nothing to suggest that this was going to be for Abraham a momentous day. Maybe that's been true of you. And you came to church just the way you'd done for years and years. But this day, God spoke to your heart. And you were brought to believe in the Savior. Or this day, you came to church burdened and fearful, and the Lord had a word which sent you home joyful and encouraged. Has it happened? Just an ordinary day. But what a momentous day it turned out to be. So let's look at Abraham in this chapter and see how things turned out for him. First of all, we notice the visitors from heaven. What a momentous day. Abraham received visitors from heaven. It was the middle of the day, the hottest part. It's not surprising to find that he's resting in the door of his tent in the shade, presumably keeping out of the direct sunlight. And as Abraham was sitting there, he saw three men standing in front of him. Three strangers, whom he presumed were traveling from one place to another, and at that point had simply reached the door of his tent. Abraham does not recognize the visitors. They are simply, for him, three men he had never seen before. But we know the visitors have come from heaven. One is the Lord himself. The chapter opens by telling us that the Lord appeared to Abraham near these great trees of Mamre. The other two are angels. Chapter 19 tells us that in the opening verse, the two angels who left Abram. And so these visitors have come from heaven. Why had they come? What was the purpose for which they had come to Abraham's door? Well, they'd come, as we see, with a message. They'd come to bring to Abraham a message recorded here in verse 10. Then the Lord said, I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, will have a son. The promise previously given to Abraham was soon to be fulfilled. The covenant line is going to be established through this son who will soon be born to Abraham and to Sarah. The Lord is confirming his promise and making more of it known. This is for Abraham a remarkable moment, though initially it seemed to be quite ordinary. Three visitors from heaven. Now, Abraham is for us a great example. He's a great example because of the way in which he treated the visitors. He treated them with the greatest of courtesy and with generous hospitality. You see, this unexpected visit was seen not as an intrusion into his daily routine, not as an interruption of his needed rest, not as something which upset his schedule or made demands on his time. This is seen as a providential opportunity to show hospitality to a stranger. Abraham has a great deal to teach us about the spirit of Christian hospitality. In fact, there seems to be a reference to this incident in the New Testament. The writer to the Hebrews is exhorting us to be hospitable. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. And then he goes on to say, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. Abraham, that's what he did. Christians are to be hospitable people. Our home is not our castle, with a drawbridge which we pull up so that no one else can get in. We cannot read the New Testament without saying that hospitality is an integral part of the Christian's calling. Think of the many verses where that's expressed. Show hospitality to one another without grumbling. Do not neglect to show hospitality. It's clear, isn't it? It's a clear directive. And one day, on one coming day, this will be the mark by which Christians' lives are evaluated. Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. Christians are to be hospitable. John Calvin has an interesting point here. Obviously, there was some construction work going on in Geneva when he lived there, as is the case everywhere at the moment. And several hotels were being built in the city. And Calvin lamented the building of hotels. He said, if Christians were hospitable as the Bible commands them to be, there would be no need for these hotels. Now, of course, in those days, people didn't go on holiday with cheap flights and so on. So hotels were really used not for people to have a holiday in, but for people of necessity to stay in when they came for some legitimate reason into the city. And he was saying when Christians arrive in the city, they shouldn't have to go and pay for accommodation. There should be those who will grant them hospitality. What could be more detestable, he says, than to be called inhospitable? Abraham is an example of Christian hospitality. And God honored his hospitality. Interestingly, we're told here that the visitors of heaven ate the food prepared. Not out of necessity, of course, but as an expression of their accepting of Abraham's kindness and also of concealing their identity until that moment when they were to make it known to him. You remember how Jesus, following his resurrection, met with his disciples and encouraged them in the same way. They gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it in their presence, not out of necessity, but to encourage his disciples and assure them of his presence. The visitors from heaven are received hospitably. But there's something else we need to notice. The visitor's message was rejected in unbelief. The message is given to Abraham, but Sarah overheard it. Actually, from the text, it is clear that Sarah was deliberately listening. It wasn't just that she happened to hear, she was listening purposely. And her response was one of unbelief. She laughed to herself. "Me have a son? This is impossible. This could not be." It's a laugh of unbelief, a shameful doubting of God's word. She is dismissing all the promises that have been given. It is impossible that these promises should come about. But her unbelief, though it's silently expressed in the depths of her heart where no one else can see it, her unbelief is known to the Lord. Every thought she had, every word she spoke to herself in secret, was open before him. No one knew what Sarah was thinking. No one knew how she had reacted. But everything is known to the Lord. And she is rebuked for her sin. At that very uncomfortable moment, face to face with her sin, Sarah tried the usual escape route, the one we still insist on trying. She denied her sin. "I did not laugh." It's the same usual escape route we all try to use. We find it so difficult. We find it so difficult to acknowledge our wrongdoing. And even when we're confronted with it, maybe through something we read or hear, when our conscience is awakened to it and something rings a bell in our conscience and says, "You are guilty," we still try to excuse it. "I didn't really mean that. It actually wasn't my fault." Even when we're faced with it, we try to blur the edges. Like the presenters in Blue Peter. A couple of weeks ago, the presenters in Blue Peter were embarrassed because a phone-in competition had been held, and they gave the impression that somebody out of all the thousands of children phoning in had phoned in with the right answer and won the prize. However, the phones hadn't been working that day, and a little boy who'd been walking through the studio had been asked the question and given the answer and got the prize. And they announced that this was the boy who won the phone-in competition when there hadn't been any phone-in. But someone discovered it. And the presenters of Blue Peter had to do something. And so they appeared on the program and they said, "This was a mistake." No, it wasn't. "This was a deliberate deception." But that's not what they said. They said this was a mistake. It sort of blurs the edges a bit. It doesn't sound too bad. Putting salt on your food instead of sugar, that's a mistake. Doesn't sound too bad. You see, we like to blur the edges. We like to say it was a mistake when what we really mean was, "I told a lie." Or what we should say, "That's what Sarah tried to do. I didn't laugh." But the Lord knew every thought and word. To try and blur the edges is the utmost folly. Instead of confessing her sin, in fact, she added another one to it. Sarah was afraid, so she lied and said, "I did not laugh." She couldn't avoid the fact Her sin could not be hidden, but she tried to hide it. You know, the wise man says, Sarah, that's not the thing to do. The wise man in the book of Proverbs says, whoever conceals his transgressions will not prosper, but he who confesses and forsakes them, he will obtain mercy. What's the wise thing to do? The visitors from heaven. Secondly, let's move on to notice the prayer for the city. Abraham is a friend of the Lord. Oftentimes in the Bible, that's how he's described. And the Lord gives him information that is very special. He tells him, as verse 17 says, what he is about to do. He speaks in a special way about what he's about to do. He says in verse 21, I will go down and see if what they have done, that's in the city of Sodom, is as bad as the outcry that has reached me. The Lord, of course, knows all things. He knows what every city is like. He knows how many Christians live in any given city. But he expresses his purpose here in this interesting way to impress on Abraham how seriously he takes the conduct of the citizens of Sodom. And also to impress on Abraham that his judgments are always just. That when he acts in judgment, it will be according to all the facts and there will be no miscarriage of justice. And God's revelation of what he is about to do in Sodom is given to Abraham because Abraham, as we're told, is to be the father of many nations. And this truth must be kept alive for every generation to come. I have chosen him so that he will direct his children and his household and keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just generation after generation. This truth needs to be remembered and needs to be made known. And so the Lord reveals it to Abraham. All generations to come need to know what the consequences of sin are. They need to know that God will act in judgment on sinful peoples. And the name of this city of Sodom has become synonymous with sin itself, with the sin itself, with blatant, unrestrained, shameful lust. The passage says it cries out to heaven. And what a solemn message for our day and our cities, because they are increasingly like Sodom. But you notice that the knowledge that judgment was coming prompted Abraham to pray for the city. Does it do that in us? He couldn't hear of coming judgment without praying for those who were in danger of that judgment. There's a great humanity about Abraham here. You might think he'll be really interested primarily in Lot, another member of the church. And as long as Lot and his family don't suffer under this judgment, then Abraham will be relieved. But Abraham is concerned for the city. If only 20 righteous persons are found, will the city not be spared? Because Abraham knows that the Lord does act graciously and oftentimes restrains his hand of judgment for the sake of his elect people in the world. And maybe, my friends, maybe that's why the United Kingdom and Europe and America have not yet been overthrown in judgment. Because within those nations there are righteous persons. It may well be because there is an outcry coming from our nations, as there was from this city. So how did Abraham pray? Well, there's a great boldness, isn't there? A great boldness in this intercession. 50. 45. 40. 30. 20. 10. Some might think that Abraham went too far in his intercession with God. Should he not have stopped sooner? But you see, this is the boldness of a God-given faith. And the fact that the Lord permitted him to continue shows that he wasn't displeased with Abraham's prayer. For the sake of 10, I will not destroy it. A holy boldness in prayer. But you see, holy boldness in prayer does not exist in a vacuum. It doesn't just happen whenever we're faced with some kind of crisis that we suddenly become bold in our praying. Abraham is a man of holy boldness in prayer because he is a man who lives by faith and obedience. He walks with God in faith and trust and obedience throughout his life. And the holy boldness of his prayer is an outworking of what he's like as a man day by day. And maybe that's what hinders us from being bold in our praying. We would love to be as bold and courageous as Abraham. We're praying for someone to be converted. We're praying for our land to be restored and revived. Wouldn't you love to be a bold intercessor like Abraham? But it grows out of a godly life. Along with the boldness, there is, of course, in Abraham a very deep humility. What a wonderful picture he is. He does not cross the line into presumption. He's bold, but he isn't presumptuous. He's a man of humility. And that's the right combination. Look how he talks about himself. I am dust and ashes. When did you last hear anybody describing themselves in such a humble way? Who am I? Who am I to come to the throne of grace with all my prayers and needs? He's bold, but he's humble. And that's the right combination, my friends. That is the right combination for our praying. And this prayer is heard, and it's answered not in the way that Abraham might have anticipated, not precisely according to his request. Sodom and the cities were not spared because the time for their judging had come. But one family is saved. What a marvelous demonstration of grace. One family is saved. Who can tell what might have happened to Lot if Abraham had not prayed? Who can tell? Does that not urge us to pray as he did, that God's mercy will reach down into this place, this nation, at this time, when the outcry is as strong as it was in Sodom, that people will be saved. And the answers will always come that are good and wise and right. The visitors from heaven and the prayer for the city. It was an ordinary day. It just started like any other day, sitting outside in the sun at the front door of the tent. Very, very simple. But what a momentous day. Visitors from heaven. And a heart stirred to pray. And a mighty, sovereign answer. Seen on the city of the plains and the lives of Lot and members of his family. An unforgettable day. I want to close by just pointing you to the two questions which arise in this passage. Did you notice them as we read the passage? Two marvelous questions. Take them with you. Whenever Sarah expresses her unbelief and says, "Will I really have a child now that I'm so old?" there is a question which comes from the Lord. Is anything too hard for the Lord? That's the question. Sarah, that's what you need to consider. It's a rebuke, of course. It's a warning of unbelief. It is, of course, but it also worked mightily in Sarah's heart. Because in the letter to the Hebrews, here's what we're told about her. By faith, Sarah herself received power to conceive, even when she was past the age, since she considered him faithful who had promised. At first she laughed, the laugh of unbelief. But then there came a question. Sarah, is anything too hard for the Lord? Can he not deal with your situation? Thankfully and joyfully, that question changed Sarah's heart. And her unbelief was driven out. And faith took its place. Are you facing something this morning which seems impossible? And you've said to yourself, there is no solution. And you're thinking about somebody and you say, I don't think he can be converted. I don't think she can be changed. I don't think the church can be revived. I don't think the situation can be restored, or this man can be brought back again to his walk with God. Is anything too hard for the Lord? Let that question drive out unbelief. But there is another question, which Abraham asks as he prays for the deliverance of the city from judgment. And he says, will not the judge of all the earth do right? Will not the judge of all the earth do right? And you see, Abraham, as he asks the question, already knows the answer. He knows that God is just. He knows that in his dealings with men, he always acts injustice. Nothing is ever unfair. No mistakes are ever made. We look out at a world where men treat each other unfairly. They don't act justly. The wicked and the righteous are treated in the same way. But will not the judge of all the earth do right? It is the justice of God which not only encourages us living in such an unjust world, but it is the justice of God which assures us this morning of our eternal salvation. Listen to Paul. And he says, this is why, my friends, this is why you're saved. Because God is just. We are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, so that he might be just and the one who justifies the man who has faith in Jesus. Isn't that good? Isn't that good? Isn't it good that Abraham said, even though we knew the answer, will not the judge of all the earth do right?